transport and medicine to farming, energy, and education. The preoccupation running across most industries today is simple. What does the future look like? And how are we going to set ourselves and humankind up for success in 2050, or say 500 years? Investment and advancement in new technologies runs underneath all of this, of course, as we work every day on creating happier, healthier, and more prosperous places to live. But as we look forward, who is stuck in the past? How about fashion and clothing? While brands are very on board with being leaders in impact and sustainable practice, is anyone thinking about what clothes might look like in the future? Or in creating pieces that will outlast their owners? Or those that will help defend us and make us stronger against our surroundings? The most exciting brand and a clear leader in innovation in this space is the men's outerwear brand Vullaback. The company was launched in 2015 by twin brothers Nick and Steve Tidbull, a brand they dreamed up while running ultra-marathons all around the world, pushing clothing beyond its limits in the most extreme conditions. Today, leaning heavily on science and technology, their team creates pieces from materials most have never thought to use in clothing. From a graphene jacket that can absorb heat and keep you warm, to solar-charged running kit and an iridescent jacket incorporating glass spheres to reflect light for high visibility, and even a puffer jacket made from Dyneema, billed as the world's strongest fiber. You're listening to The Entrepreneurs with me, Daniel Bage. For this week's show, I sat down with Steve Tidbull, company CEO and co-founder, to hear the story of Vullaback.
Well, it's really funny. In the early days of the brand, we used to feel that we had to tell a really tight story that was really precise and that people could understand. And then as the brand evolved over time, we actually got more uncomfortable telling that, and we got more into, okay, why did we actually start and the reality of that? Because the reality is quite messy, and a lot of brands who want to tell their story come up with this like really PR-able stuff. And the fact is we were racing around the world. We'd raced across the Alps, raced across the Amazon, raced across the Namibian desert. And one of the things we saw is there were a series of physical and psychological challenges that essentially weren't being addressed. And in our minds, no one had possibly thought that clothing could be the solution to them. You might think like nutrition was the solution. You might think reading a book about like your psychology would be the solution. And we essentially got to this idea, but you know, the one thing you're guaranteed to take on any adventure is clothing. Like you have to. You're not going to go naked across the Amazon, across the Arctic. And so the question we started asking ourselves, but very, very messily at the start, is could clothing solve these challenges? And so I think one of the sort of two key moments in how we started the idea of the company as opposed to the, like the actuality of the business. And one of them was in the Namibian desert. And we were preparing to race a 24-hour ultramarathon across the desert. You know, the next day it was going to be, you know, plus 40 degrees. You know, jackals would turn out to be hunting us at night. Like, it's some really, like, quite fun stuff to be up against. And so the one thing you want to go into that race, you want to be well-trained. You want to be, you know, good nutrition. But you also want to be well-slept. And the reality is, like, we were sleeping in tents in the middle of the desert, and hardly anyone could sleep because you're so nervous and you're so, like, it's called the anticipatory response, right? You're so wired about what's going to happen the next day, so that you go into the biggest race of your life wanting to be really well-rested, and you might have got half an hour's sleep. And we just went in and went, this is absolutely crazy. So that was one of the first challenges we ever actually faced. Like, before that, like, I'd done lots of sport as a kid, but I'd never put my life on the line where you go, okay, if this goes wrong, you could actually die. You know, like big wave surfers or free divers. And that was the first moment we'd done that. And it was the first moment it hit me of like, okay, well, I wonder how you could actually solve this challenge. Like, we were working in advertising at the time, so we were always thinking, how do you solve an idea? Like, if this is a problem, how do you solve it? And so we just wondered if a piece of clothing could solve that, and I'll come to sort of what we did in a minute. And then the other challenge we faced was when I actually did nearly die in that race, so I wasn't allowed to go on to do the next race in the Amazon. But my brother went on and my teammates went on. And this was a sort of six-day ultramarathon through the Amazon. And at the end of it, you know, your clothes are covered in blood and sort of feces and ants and wasps and all sorts of like really gross stuff. And at the end of the race, all the people competing put their kit in a pile and burnt it. And I remember thinking at the time when I heard this story, this is just completely insane. Like, you're going to this really like quite in crazy place, like sort of this very ecologically special place. And you're holding a bonfire. A bunch of Westerners are basically having a bonfire in South America. And there's only 30 of them, so the impact's not going to be huge, but it's real nonetheless. And those two things combined of, like, it's an incredibly messy start, but, like, could we start to come up with the solutions for these? Which feels kind of really both it's stupid and arrogant because like we had no background in clothing. But in the end, the first piece of clothing we ever designed was like a hoodie designed to chill you out. Right. Now, the reality is you wouldn't actually take the hoodie we designed to Namibia because it's too hot, because it zips up over your face. But the principle remains of like, okay, could you use colour theory, could you use body position in order to encourage someone to chill out?
Right.
And then it took us probably actually the best part of 3.5 years to solve the please don't burn your clothes solution. And earlier this summer, we invented like a T-shirt made entirely out of plants and algae. And so it's grown in forests and bioreactors. And when you are finished with a T-shirt, so it lasts as long as you want, lasts like any cotton T-shirt. But when you are finished with it, it's never been through any chemical process. It's never had any dyes. It's incredibly low resource usage in terms of how it's constructed. You can just bury it in the ground and it'll turn into worm food within 12 weeks. So one solution with the sort of relaxation we came up with incredibly fast, like probably within the space of a week, we kind of come up with that idea. And then the other one, the technology and the partners we needed took us sort of, you know, 4 years to actually find and evolve. So we always start with really curious ideas that are quite strange and people don't think clothing is the solution to. And in doing that, you sort of, you start to operate on timescales that a sort of typical Adidas or Nike wouldn't. Because you don't rush yourself. You go, okay, when do I actually have the solution to this idea?
You talked about the controlled narrative of a lot of companies and being former admin. When you started to play around with this first product, how soon did you want to tighten that narrative? Or was it more of what it's sounding like, I think, and that you sort of were willing to see where it was going to take you, and that, you know, we'll come on to the other products like the biodegradable T-shirt and things like that and solutions you're trying to solve. But how early were you trying to sort of tighten that narrative of what you guys could be?
Well, at the start, not that much. We were very fascinated by the idea that if NASA made clothes, what would they make? And we were fascinated by the idea of El Bulli, the sort of famous Spanish restaurant. If they were to make clothes, what would they make? And if you were to combine those two things, what would that look like? So we certainly came in with a starting principle of here's the way we're going to approach making clothes. But I don't think we came in with a controlled narrative in the sense that we want people to perceive us in a certain way, because I think it's always quite dangerous as a company to come into a market and go, we want people to think X, because very likely people aren't going to think it. Mm. And the more you try to control that, the often the harder it can become. I think one of the things we always remain open to is the most unlikely sources can help you sharpen your brand. So originally when we created the pink hoodie, we'd call it something complicated. I think the Baker Miller pink relaxation hoodie, because the original color was named Baker Miller pink after the original psychology experiments.
And this is the one we saw on Jimmy Fallon.
That's right.
Right.
And then John Glazer, the US comedian, happened to take it onto Jimmy Fallon, completely unorganized by us. And those guys started referring it to as the relaxation hoodie. And it's like, oh, well, that's a way better name. And so suddenly you have like a really famous US comedian doing a branding for you. So this is what I talk about in terms of like, you've got to have that flexibility. So we could have, you know, we could have written them a letter and say, please refer to it in the correct name. Or you could just go, that's a better name, we're going to use that. So forevermore, it's renamed it the relaxation hoodie. And I think that's what we always think about in terms of like, you can try and control a narrative, but then a really famous US comedian who you don't know can rename one of your products and you can go with it. Mm. And so I think that's the kind of like, we try to think flexibly like that when you're coming up with creative problem solving, because you're not always going to crack it. Like if you're Apple, like that's different, right? You've got thousands of people making sure that when something goes to market, it's absolutely perfect. A lot of our stuff in the early days, especially, was really quite experimental. And so it's very hard to go to market and go, this is the perfect iteration. Maybe it's not. Mm. Maybe it's just your starting point. And one of the things we've always tried to encourage is like a really direct relationship with our customers. We're not a huge brand with big shops. Like we only sell online. We chat to all these guys personally. If they come up with an idea, we'll quite often run with it. So that's one kind of idea we've carried through the brand from the very start to where we are today, which is being a lot more receptive to feedback and ideas than other like large clothing brands might be. We try and build that in.
It looks to me in the way you present it as well that you're trying to show people the entire life cycle of products, and something that the market really hasn't done. And I know a lot of brands now are talking up sustainability and how they can have less of an impact, but the big way they can do that is to buy less and to wear their clothes for longer, I guess. And in the products that you've made, I think you have a little bit of both. A T-shirt that biodegrades and a jacket that's going to last 5,000 years. So I guess that's where you're coming at this from, right? Is it the whole life cycle of what these things can be?
Yeah, we've approached the idea of life cycle from two different angles. So I definitely agree that we I mean, there's no denying we live in like an incredibly consumerist culture, and you know, social media and stuff only encourages that. I think there's also the economic realities that inform it, which is while there are sort of discrepancies around the world in how much people are paid, the big clothing brands will always be able to find cheap labor in countries, and as long as you can find cheap labor, you can produce cheap clothing. And we looked at it from the completely opposite end, which is, well, what if we just made clothes with more ambition? So I suppose the two pieces that really resonate most on that are the plant and algae t-shirt, which biodegrades once you've finished with it. And yeah, we have our 100-year clothing range, which is like, it's inevitably a moonshot, right? It's very, very difficult to devise testing to decide if something is going to last exactly 100 years for everybody who possibly wears it. But simply by setting ourselves that challenge, we can't look at commercially available materials. We have to work with mills who kind of have completely different ambitions. We have to look at a completely different subset of materials. We have to think outside of materials that are typically used for clothing. And so a lot of it is about setting ourselves such ambitious goals that you can't possibly follow what the market is doing. And then setting it from two ends of the spectrum. So as you say, like the t-shirt that biodegrades, like that's, you know, like, it's really funny, like, cotton can last ages. You still have clothes left over from the Egyptians, which is thousands of years ago, and it's just some cotton sewn together. So clothes can last for a really, really long time. But I think one of the things that people aren't necessarily aware of is how long they can last. And so as you have sort of transient fashion, people think about clothing very different ways. If you think about it as a status symbol, the thing that gives you, you know, status, or, you know, do I look cool today, this week, might not necessarily work for 2 years' time. And so one of the things we try to do with, like, even the way we name clothes is make you think about it in a different ways. If we call it a pair of 100-year pants, you're going to think about it differently. You're not going to be thinking, what pair of pants do I buy next year? And if we think about, like, one of the things we wanted to do with the plant and algae t-shirt, and, like, well, we've been so kind of, like, bullish on what you should do with it, is we think that reality of, you know, when someone's finished with it and they bury it in the garden, you're not going to forget that. You're not going to forget the day you buried your t-shirt, because it's so outside of what you would normally do. And so we think about it on a very minute perspective, even from a naming strategy of, like, if we call it plant and algae t-shirt and then we make a little video of it, as we did, of like, here is what happens when worms eat it, that's quite hard to forget. And so it kind of falls into marketing as well. Like, there's a lot of brands at the moment, and that's okay, sort of like talking about sustainability, but you've got to do it in a way that people find relevant and interesting. And so, yeah, we've approached it from those two different angles. Maybe this piece of clothing will outlast you, and maybe this piece of clothing will be eaten by worms. And it's quite hard to forget those two things. So that's the way we've thought about it, as opposed to the way other brands might necessarily have approached the same challenge.
Are there target customers? Who do you work for? Because it seems to be military strength. You're talking about space. You're talking about all these things. So who do you actually make this stuff for?
What was really interesting is we never actually set out with a target customer in mind. We always set out with what happens if we make the world's most interesting clothing. And the reality is it's been a magnet for some really, really interesting people. So within there, you obviously get sort of, you know, military, you get explorers, you get adventurers, you get extreme sports athletes. But at the same time, we draw a lot of people who are very attracted to the future. So we get a lot of doctors, a lot of scientists, a lot of venture capital. And so essentially anyone who's kind of interested in where the world is going to go is kind of automatically drawn to our brand. We never set out to design for a particular archetype. I think one of the things we were always really conscious of is our focus was always going to be on what's the future of clothing going to look like. And the most interesting sort of lens for us to shoot that through is adventure sport, because the reality is these are people putting their lives on the line, and that's when it's actually going to matter. So if you make this a fashion brand, you don't actually have to make the future, because there's nothing resting on it. But if you know that this is going to be worn by, you know, someone who's going into one of the most hostile environments on earth, or has to be self-sufficient for a month, well, this stuff really has to work. That's when it moves from, oh, it's a cool story, to this is real functioning kit. And so that was one of the things we were really sort of like strong on when we first started the brand, which is it's got to be the future, but it's also got to work in really interesting ways. One of the most interesting exercises we ever did was this jacket made from, well, at least one side is coated in graphene or graphene nanoparticles. And we literally put it out as an experiment. We said, look, like, one side's coated in graphene, which has the capability it has that nothing really else has, is it can store and distribute heat. And so it can kind of work like a radiator on your body, even though the material is very, very thin. But in our positioning, in the way we say, look, we've done this, we think it can do these things, please go out and test it for us, you're kind of opening up R&D in a really interesting way. And that does just tend to attract a certain type of person. Mm. Like, if you want the latest, like, Arc'teryx jacket that's been put through this exact testing and you know it's worked for these people, then that's cool. That's not quite the brand we're making. We're much more interested in, you know, maybe this thing we've made is 95% of the way there. Will you tell us that final 5%? Will you go out and be our R&D lab? Like, when you're not a huge company, if you don't have the benefit of like thousands of people working for you, you can at least turn to your customers and go, why don't you help us? And that's the thing that we've found has resonated really well and people have been very receptive to. And we couldn't have built the brand without our customers, which is a kind of like a really obvious thing to say. But in our case, it does sort of function like an R&D department, which is like a really interesting thing for us.
Tell me about where you started to look back to nature as well, where things already work. You've done these amazing pieces with biomimicry. Tell me where you started to think about that.
Well, one of the things you think about as a designer is actually if you look out into nature and you're a designer, you have just a wild inferiority complex because the systems out there that just humanity, it's going to take us thousands and thousands of years to replicate. And so one of the things we started looking at, actually driven out of our sporting experiences again, we were racing through the Alps called the Ultra Trail de Mont Blanc. And it's a pretty tough race. It's like 120 miles over the Alps. You've got about 48 hours. And during the year we were racing, the visibility was not zero, but you had 5 meters and you might be on a mountain peak. And you start to think quite a lot about, can I see and can anyone see me? And so that's where we first started to think about visibility. And as soon as you start to think about visibility in a way that doesn't involve batteries or technology, because you often when you're racing, you're in quite remote environments where you don't want to be relying on stuff like that. We started to think, okay, what are the systems in nature that we could mimic? Randomly, I think we started to look at fireflies and this kind of like this glow in the dark stuff. And we just got really fascinated by, could this possibly be replicated? So the first piece of sort of like biomimicry clothing we ever created was what we call the solar charge jacket, which is essentially a very, very lightweight running jacket made out of material that can store and re-emit sunlight. Or actually any light. Like, you can put your iPhone torch on it and sort of write anything you want on it. And this was the first product became sort of like really fascinated by, okay, what could the capabilities of clothing be in sort of keeping you safe and visible versus just the normal sort of stuff you might see as you ride about town, which is very shiny. And that led us to look further, and we ended up working with quite a lot of glass stuff. We created the most visible creature on Earth. It's called the blue morpho butterfly, and you can see it from like 5 kilometers away in the jungle because it basically has iridescent wings. So basically it has microstructures on its wings that reflect light back in a very crazy way. And we thought, oh, wouldn't it be cool to make a jacket like that? So we made a jacket called the blue morpho jacket based on the butterfly, which is kind of like a relatively dull blue during the day. But as light strikes it, it just basically kicks all the light back at you. So we became really interested in these concepts. Now, the thing we're starting to do now is we're starting to work with kind of like scientific institutions to go, okay, how far can this go? Because ultimately, the reality is if you're going to sort of copy nature, you move towards squids are the ultimate example of it. They can make themselves practically invisible against their environments. They can sort of radiate these crazy colours and patinations across their body. And so as soon as you make nature your sort of guide of where you can do, the kind of possibilities are endless. And so we try to do that as much as possible. The reality is there's huge limitations still. Like, even if you had, you know, hundreds of millions of pounds, like, it's still very, very hard to crack some of these things. So we look for what we're interested in is kind of really fascinating interim solutions that lead us on the way to much bigger breakthroughs, like, you know, like invisibility or, you know, crazy stuff that, you know, might still be, you know, 2 decades or 3 decades away from. We're interested in taking the first steps. The way we look at it is someone's got to. And when you look around, I couldn't really see anyone doing it. And so you think, okay, well, were we the people to have a crack at that? And biomimicry is one of the most, yeah, challenging things we've taken on today, I'd say.
Tell me about the mimicry in the cockroach that you've done with this amazing puffer jacket, which I'm seeing a lot of these days. It is incredible because you've worked with metal, and I think it weighs something like 4,000 grams. It's quite the high-tech jacket, but it's quite a heavy jacket as well, we should say.
Yeah, so it's not quite made out of metal yet, although we're working on something like that. This one's made out of a material called Dyneema, which was sort of invented in the late 60s and absolutely wasn't invented for clothing, and it was found by accident. Like, lots of really good materials are sort of found by accident. The approach for this was really simple, which is the thing that's most likely to end up in landfill quickest is your puffer jacket. And given it's like one of the most expensive things you can buy, And given that many of them are made in not massively environmentally sound ways, we thought, well, this is really crazy that these are getting ripped first. And so the first thing we looked at is, well, why are puffer jackets getting destroyed so quickly? And the reality is because there's this kind of absolute prioritization of lightweightness, which is absolutely okay. Like if you're sort of, you know, climbing a mountain or, you know, really performing some kind of extreme activity, lightweightness is absolutely king. If you're walking along the street, it's not necessarily the thing that's going to make or break you. And so we looked at where the industry was going, which was towards really lightweight jackets filled with down. And we went, well, what's the opposite way to go? Because I don't necessarily think either of these are the correct thing to do. Mm. Like, having looked a lot at down, we thought there's got to be a better solution. Like if you came to the problem of how do you keep a human being warm from scratch, I don't think your instant solution is going to be, let's pull the feathers out of the neck of this duck. That's not like the obvious thing that you would go to. And the same with if you are to make a coat that's going to be really quite expensive, let's not make it out of a really lightweight, rippable material. So it's a really interesting example of the industry has gone so far one way that it's almost unquestioned where it's gone to. And so as soon as you run in the opposite direction, you get some really quite interesting answers. So we ended up filling our jacket with recycled plastic bottles, which had been mechanically pulverized, so not even a chemical in sight. So in terms of how that plastic becomes a thing that acts like down to insulate you. So that's where we started. So no ducks involved, because that wasn't really what we wanted to do. And then the second thing is like, okay, what's the housing for this? You know, if you're going to sell a jacket for $1,000, you probably want it to last beyond this ski season. And so we essentially went on the hunt for the strongest material on earth. The thing we found was Dyneema, which is 15 times stronger than steel, weight for weight, which is very funny because you can like hold it in your hands and you can bend it like any normal material.
It's used in shipping rope?
Yeah. So where it actually started off was in shipping ropes in giant container ships in places like the Arctic that would get frozen in deep ice. And that's where you really need ropes to work, because if it doesn't, then you've got a real problem. It also started off in the paneling on tanks in order to stop like basically bombs, and in bulletproof armor. And we're like, we basically thought, well, if the material is used in all of these things, what if you could use it in clothing? So we found a special version of it called Dyneema Black. And as soon as we found lots of people saying this wasn't necessarily the best thing to put in clothing, we thought, oh, this is a really interesting idea. Because, like, you know, the factory had to find very special types of needles that could be used to work with this, because it's just not a normal material. Mm. The industry is not set up necessarily to work in the most interesting and innovative ways. And so you often, when you do start these processes, you often have to sort of battle through traditional setups that say, well, no, the puffer jacket has to be light. We use these 10 materials. And so as soon as you bring them this thing and you go, it's 15 times stronger than steel, see if you can make something with it, then you get some quite interesting conversations.
If we look at that jacket, we should point out, and you do point out on the website, it doesn't actually stop bullets. Maybe it will in the future, but
one day we're working.
One day. You won't snag it. It's not going to rip. You could take a knife to it. The jacket will be absolutely fine. You talk about the future of clothing, what that might look like. I'm curious about the people who are interested in the brand. You've already brought up government, military, VCs, people that are very curious. Where are they positioned around the company? You guys are still a very small brand. And how curious are they about the progress, the process, what you guys are coming out with? And how do you work with people that way while still trying to, I guess, maintain the integrity of what you guys do?
Well, I think the reality is, like, people are fascinated. And I think simply because we've taken such a different approach. I think if we'd tried to fit into that standard model of basically being really commercial from day one, absolutely we'd have come out with a blue ski jacket and a red ski jacket. But that was never the thing we were interested in. So we don't tend to attract the types of people who would behave in more normal ways, I guess is the way of putting it. We tend to attract people who are a little more sort of like forward thinking. The level of interaction is kind of enormous. Like, it was one of the things that I was really, really passionate about from the moment we started the business, of like, I want to chat to everyone who's part of this company. And so one of the things we did, there's a guy called Tony Shea who started a company called Zappos, and essentially he sold to Amazon eventually. But he built it around, let's just do the most amazing customer service in the world. And there's all sorts of tales about things that their customer service, like agents, went on to do for people. Like chatting for 6 hours, sending someone a free pizza, just really silly stuff. And I always thought, wouldn't it be amazing to start a company that's both futuristic but really friendly? And I know that's a very sort of like simple way of thinking about it, but I think one of the things that people tend to think about the future is it's kind of like really barren, and it's Blade Runner and it's Mad Max, and no one talks to each other anymore. And we thought it would be really, really nice to align two values, which is one of like we try and do the most futuristic stuff as possible, but we chat to people about it and we chat really nicely. And so one of the things I've always wanted to do is chat to people in the most friendly ways possible. So if like we did a really silly thing recently. Well, the idea of piece of clothing is not silly, but the marketing maybe is. We launched the first piece of clothing that we designed for space. It's called a deep sleep cocoon. And the idea is it's designed to help you sleep in the most inhospitable places on Earth and also inhospitable places in space. And we decided one of the funny ways to advertise this would to be build or create a fake asteroid mining company. Because in the future, in 50 years' time, that's what we're going to be doing in space. There's going to be people mining asteroids. And then we decided to run a recruitment campaign for that asteroid mining company in the New York Times. So, like, it's a silly idea on top of a silly idea, right? But then the reaction to this was absolutely amazing. Like, we had so many people apply for this job. And the starting date was 2084. And so we had all these people apply, like, they'd never heard about us, and they were applying for this job in the New York Times. And they knew it was a joke, right? But they were applying for this job, and every single one we went back to, it's like, well, tell us more about your CV. What kind of experience do you have? And we just carried on playing this kind of story with them. And I think that's not something that's ever going to make you famous, but it is something that makes me really proud to run a company that kind of behaves in this kind of really curious way. Like, that's not necessarily the best way to make money, but it is a really, really interesting way to make a company, because it makes people think in quite interesting and profound ways about the future that they might not otherwise be thinking about. And I think it's really interesting, because you could have run a, you know, full page ad in the New York Times going, we've invented clothes for space. Or you could do something really interesting that kind of drives that kind of curiosity. And to go back to your original question, that attracts a certain type of person. It attracts a kind of like people with very playful, curious minds who are very interested in the future. Now, they might be across all sorts of jobs. We'll have rocket scientists, brain surgeons, adventurers, but they're more united by a mindset than they are by their job or by their geography. And that's what's been most interesting. And it's what's enabled us to actually to become a global brand. That sounds far too grand, but a brand that sells to every country on Earth almost from week one, because you will find lots of people like that around the world. And it doesn't really matter if they're in Switzerland or Hong Kong or New York. They're going to be thinking in the kind of ways that you're thinking, and they're going to be drawn to you.
Very well said. In so much as you could say, with the curiosity that you guys have and going forward, what else might you be working on? What could you tell us today about some of the things you might have in the works?
So I'm really interested in going like quite deep into science. So one of the things we've done so far that I've been really fascinated by is not being too worried about timescales. And so I think in that vein, we're starting a series of partnerships with entities much larger than us in space and biotech, and some very interesting areas where it's more just taking the first step. And so we're getting a lot deeper into the science. So far, we've been very interested in the materiality of how stuff is made. But what we're increasingly fascinated by is the level of interaction you can have between your clothing and your body. Because I think one of the things that you're guaranteed to do is you're always going to be wearing clothes. So I think one of the most fascinating case studies I've ever seen is sort of Google Glass, which was an amazing, amazing sort of like scientific breakthrough, but it required a real change in behaviour. It required everyone to get up and go, I'm going to put a headset on today. And people aren't quite ready for that yet. Whereas I think what I find particularly fascinating about clothing is you are going to put it on today. It doesn't matter if you're, you know, I'm wearing a blue shirt, you're wearing a grey shirt. It could have been our pyjamas, but you're definitely going to wear something. And the way we start to think about that is, okay, well, if it's going to be on your body, what could it become? In space, obviously, your clothing becomes your breathing system. I think on Earth, it's going to become the system that delivers medicine to you. I think it's going to become your doctor. I think if we look at exoskeletons, it's going to become a source of strength. I think it's going to start to alter your sensory perception. And so where we're headed is we're starting to make those first steps into what is clothing going to become. Because ultimately, I think that's what someone has to do. And if everyone continues to think about clothing as what colour do people like, or what am I going to be wearing this season, clothing is never going to become the solution to problems. But if we start to ask it much harder questions, which is what we're starting to do last year or this year and onwards, if you start to ask it much harder questions, it's likely to become much more involved in the future than it otherwise would be. If you think about where we will be headed in, you know, 10, 20, 30 years, especially as space becomes a reality, I think you start to think of areas of second skins. I think you start to think of areas where the medicalization of clothing. I think we're at a really, really curious point where we actually know remarkably little about ourselves, and yet there's something touching your skin all the time that could be receiving and processing an enormous amount of information. So we are taking what might be called bold or stupid steps into the future by asking clothing to do things that it's not done before. That's what's next.
Steve Tidbull, co-founder and CEO of Volabac. My thanks to Steve for coming in to share his story, and to Christy Evans, who mixed and edited this program. I'm Daniel Bache. Thank you so much for listening, and goodbye.